This is Talk Is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also on radioforall.net. All right, this is the second half of Nancy Bray's lecture on the farm workers' mushroom boycott and the history of the farm worker movement, Cesar Chavez movement, boycott windmill mushrooms
or mushrooms from Sunnyside, Washington.
The United Farm Workers are boycotting windmill mushrooms
or mushrooms from Sunnyside, Washington.
That's coming up here. But before I do that, I have some information on, I did some research on Venezuela. This is something I've followed off and on over the years. And what happens is when you research Venezuela, what comes up, the timeline and what they're reporting on all the news media, even the left-wing media, is this timeline starts, and please research this yourself, use your own brain at all times. Their timeline starts at Cesar Chavez, or they go all the way back to Simon Bolivar, which, for those of you who don't know, all of South and Central America was a Spanish colony. They were colonists just like the British, and they exploited the native population, the indigenous populations of these areas for years, brutally, put them in slavery. And then Simon Bolivar actually threw the Spanish out of South America. So that's, and please, again, research this yourself. That's an oversimplification. But it was amazing. It's actually a pretty amazing story. But what they all leave out is in the 50s, the 1950s, when the oil companies went into Venezuela to extract the oil. And what they did, so what I've got for you here is, this is the Standard Oil movie, publicity movie called Venezuela 1950s Standard Oil Travel Log. It's Caracas 94224, if you want to look it up on YouTube. And again, please research this stuff yourself. But in this video, what it says is they were importing, Venezuela was importing, instead of being self-sufficient, by the way, they were importing from the United States $1 billion worth of goods in the 1950s. But they were exporting $2 billion worth of oil in the 1950s from Venezuela. So that's 100% profit on their money. Okay, now that's an oversimplification because to be fair, the video goes on to say that they put housing and things that the Standard Oil Company, you know, just like other exploitive industries, they did put some housing, you know, just like the Hershey firm in Pennsylvania and people like and places like that, and they put some housing in for 50,000 workers. Okay, but at the time there's 6 million, and you'll hear him say this, there's 6 million people in Venezuela. So again, what about all the other people? So when I research this, and again, please research this yourself, just a cursory glance at Wikipedia, over and over they had these presidents of Venezuela were being thrown out because President Betancourt, they wanted to nationalize the oil industry like Chavez did back in the 1950s, and which means that the oil companies would be thrown out and the government would own the oil industry in Venezuela. And so that means all your knowledge goes out with the oil industry. So, and the oil industry, you know, has a lot of knowledge on how to run this equipment. So instead of doing that, he asked them to pay 50% of their profits in taxes, President Betancourt, to pay 50% of their taxes. And so, of course, they threw him out. They did, you know, so they kept fixing elections. And, you know, again, you can research this yourself. It's questionable. But anyway, they kept having different people in there until finally in the 1990s they had a crisis because caused by our interest rates, our currency manipulation, that we use interest rates to manipulate the currency, and the oil prices collapsed, and they call it Dutch disease when all your revenue comes from one resource. Instead of making them self-sufficient, instead of America giving aid to them to make them self-sufficient, we gave them, and this is what they thought was right back then, they put corporations down there to extract their resources and give them money. But again, but even they feel they don't give them enough money. And by the way, this is the same thing that happened in the Russian Revolution. All the oil industry left Russia when the Soviet Union started because they nationalized the oil industry. And instead of staying there and helping them develop the greatest oil resources, the Baku region of Russia, greatest oil reserves at the time, instead of helping them fairly extract that resource and giving the money to all the people, the oil industry left. And then they did basically the same thing in the 90s when the Soviet Union finally fell, when Reagan used brinksmanship, nuclear brinksmanship, to bring down the Soviet Union, dangerously bring down the Soviet Union. They did the same thing. They left them to their own devices instead of helping them turn into even a marginal capitalist society, even a fair, if there is such a thing, a fair small business capitalist society is what we could have done if we if you're really against communism. We could have helped Russia become, you know, a self-sufficient nation. So we've done this over and over again. So that's what this video is about. And if I may, I'm sorry I'm rambling on, but let me just give you one more example, okay? Just to show you how long I've watched this stuff and have a little bit of background on this. I'm not a political science major or anything like that, but in 1980, I had this teacher who spent the whole semester in a government class on Orwell, right? He spent 10 weeks on Orwell. And so he comes in one day, and he shows us this article from the Wall Street Journal that says, look at these oil companies. They made, I think it was, don't hold me to the numbers. It was something like, but I'll get the percentages were correct. But I think it was $6 billion return. Look at this article in the Wall Street Journal. It was an advertisement saying, and the oil company said they made $6 billion return on oil because they want you to invest in Standard Oil, right? And so look, this is obscene. And so I go home to my father, and my father was a vice president of Home Savings and Loan, which back then he didn't make that much money, really, as not like bankers do now. He was just basically a glorified loan officer. He loaned on tracts of houses back in the 60s and 70s and early 80s. So I take this home. I go to my dad. Look at these oil companies. They made all this money. And he goes, well, what you didn't see, what he doesn't tell you, is they invested $100 billion. To make that, I think it was $6 billion return, because they only made 6% return on their investment. Okay, so, and you know, if you go down to the bank, usually you can make 6%. Usually businesses, 25% is a huge amount of profit. You don't make 100% profit. So, but keep in mind, this is after they've spent this article, they're showing you their 6% return on investment after everything they've spent, and it was bragging about how much money they made their investors. And they did this by exploiting people and the environment and ruining the planet that they should be paying us reparations for right now. So that's what they're not telling you about Venezuela. And I've said it before, I was buying Citgo gas because I didn't want to buy gasoline when I drove my car, because I rode my bike all through my youth, rode a bike, but I still had a car. I would buy from Citgo gas because it came from Venezuela, because I didn't want to support the Middle East oil. So that's why I know Citgo gas was from Venezuela. And so when Trump came into office, he made oil exports illegal from Venezuela just to punish Maduro and Chavez, who are it's true, they are, and so is Putin, they are despot dictators just like Trump is. But the reason they're in there is there's a reason that's been caused by U.S. corporate foreign economic policy. Okay, and one thing about U.S. aid, okay, it depends on what type of aid. There's, you know, do we sponsor state sponsorship of multinational corporations? Or aid has been used in Syria to stop the rise of ISIS, which is a good thing. So there's a thing, and this relates to Venezuela and Central and South America also, called the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, or OPIC. Not OPIC, but OPIC was the United States government's the United States government's development finance institution until it merged with the Development Credit Authority of the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, to form the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation, mobilizing private capital to help solve critical development challenges and in doing so advance the foreign policy of the United States and national security objectives. Okay, now this, they claim, this is from a Wikipedia article, please research this yourself, but they claim that the taxpayer doesn't, it doesn't cost taxpayers any money, but keep in mind, they're taking your tax dollars, loaning it to small businesses and large corporations to invest overseas in other countries, and then they insure them against the risk, which again, taxpayer doesn't pay for. They're paid back. I don't know how the insurance works, but anyway, so OPIC's political risk insurance enabled U.S. businesses to take advantage of commercially attractive opportunities in emerging markets, mitigating risk and helping them compete in a global marketplace. OPIC helped U.S. investors protect their investments in a variety of situations, including political violence, expropriation, or other government interferences, and currency inconvertibility. So they're talking about, you know, other governments. If the government tries to stop you from exploiting people, you're insured for that. And I can't believe that the U.S. taxpayer doesn't pay for that. But according to the Wikipedia article, we don't pay for that. So that, then under the criticism part of the Wikipedia article, it says, in the 2000s, Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace, and cities of Boulder, Arcata, and Oakland won against the Overseas Private Investment Corporation and the Export-Import Bank of the United States, which were accused of financing fossil fuel projects detrimental to a stable climate in violation of the National Environmental Policy Act in a case filed in 2002 and settled in 2009. So yeah, what type of aid are we giving the world? And that's what you're going to hear over and over again on this show. Talk is cheap. So thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media. Coming up, Nancy Bray's Q&A. On the boycott of windmill mushrooms
or mushrooms from Sunnyside, Washington
at World Pies from December 8th. And you can contact, get more information on from Nancy Bray at branj@gmail.com. And it's Eugene Friends of the Farm Workers, branj@gmail.com. Thanks for supporting independent media.
Hello, I'm Cal Thomas. I've just been reading about Simon Bolivar. Bolivar, the great patriot of Latin America, fought for the freedom of not just one country, but for the freedom of six Spanish colonies in Latin America. An entire country, Bolivia, is named in honor of him. Another country he freed from the rule of Spain is Venezuela, where he was born and which today uses the Bolivar as a unit of currency. In Bolivar's day, Venezuela was a land of mountains, plains, and jungles, broken by scattered plantations called haciendas, and with only a handful of Spanish towns and villages. But great changes have come to Venezuela in recent years. I'd like you to join me on a journey to this modern country. Another sign of this country's vigor is its seaports. The most important one is La Guaira. Through its ports, Venezuela each year receives imports of goods and services worth more than $1 billion. This makes Venezuela, a nation of only 6 million people, an important customer for American products. Any country that imports well over $150 worth of goods and services for every man, woman, and child each year must have something valuable to trade in return. Venezuela does have something the rest of the free world needs. Nature has endowed her with some of the world's most precious resources: oil, iron ore, and other minerals. Venezuela exports almost $2 billion worth of oil and oil products every year, selling them to free people around the world. Not far from Lake Maracaibo is the Creole refinery at Amway. This refinery has a daily capacity of more than 250,000 barrels of oil. That means it can turn out more than 10 million gallons of gasoline, kerosene, and other fuels every day. From Amway, these products go to markets abroad in big tankers. Oil does more than maintain national prosperity and a trade balance for Venezuela. It also gives employment to 50,000 Venezuelan workers each year. To house its own workers, Creole has built modern, well-designed housing projects. The company is encouraging local contractors to build houses for sale to employees and to outsiders as well. Through a loan plan, the company offers help with a down payment to employees who desire it. This is the home of a Venezuelan oil worker. Venezuela today is indeed a country on the move, expanding and developing in all directions. Simón Bolívar would have difficulty in recognizing this nation he helped found. Here are brought together the elements that make great people and great nations. Working together are an indulgent Mother Nature, the far-sighted enterprise of an industrious people, and the good neighborliness of North and South America. That ends our journey to Venezuela. I hope it has given you an idea of how a friendly nation lives and works and grows. Perhaps you'll join me soon on another journey. Until then, goodbye.
Now, we're not done. We will show our home movie that Herb took in 1965. It has three segments: our Greet the Grapes rally at a Safeway on West 18th, and it's an example of one of our solidarity picket lines. The second segment is a rally on the EMU terrace at the U of O. It starts with Guerrilla Theater by Mecha, then UFW President Philip Veracruz speaking, and then a march to Johnson Hall. The third segment shows the March on Gallo that five Eugene Friends of the Farmworkers participated in. This segment shows the march going past the Gallo Wine headquarters and into Modesto, California. If you watch closely, you can see Cesar Chavez a few times, and also Fred Ross, who trained Cesar Chavez as an organizer, Joan Baez, and Philip Veracruz. The large rally in Modesto shows a mariachi band, and then Joan Baez performing, and several speakers, including Cesar Chavez. The movie has no sound, so while it's playing, I'm happy to answer questions. And I do have Colin Heatley, who's here from Oregon AFL-CIO, and he can also help answer the questions you may have. My tech support here is going to switch to the movie, and here comes Colin. So thank you for being such a wonderful audience.
So please raise, yes, please raise your hand. If, this doesn't seem like it's working, does it? How weird. Hello? Yes. Okay. So please raise your hands if you have questions, and I will try to run as quickly as I can over to wherever you are, and so that we can all hear your question, and then she will answer.
So questions? Your Safeway on West 18th while you're thinking of your questions.
Hello, I was wondering about the types of mushrooms that are covered by the boycott, does that include cremini mushrooms as well as white mushrooms?
Yes, Windmill has many varieties of mushrooms. Can I ask? So you really need to look at the label. And they do have some packaged, but mostly what we've seen is in bulk. So you have to see the box. And if the box is not labeled, ask the store manager. That's what I had to do at Market of Choice. They went back and came back and said, yes, these are Windmill mushrooms. So, yeah, please do check. Fortunately, there are other varieties of mushrooms that you can buy. And thank you to Organically Grown that has been here in our community. How many years? Many years. And does not buy from Windmill.
One more question. Today it was announced that the Trump administration is going to be distributing money to farmers. And I was wondering if you expect any of that to get to the workers.
No. Not at all. It'll go right to big producers, mostly. That's my understanding. Also, I'm Colin. I did not introduce myself. I am a rank-and-file member of the Graduate Teaching Fellows Federation. I'm in the history department at U of O. I am working with the UFW to try to expand the Windmill Boycott into Oregon. So thank you, Nancy, for giving this amazing presentation. But I'll be happy to answer some questions, too, if I can, if Nancy doesn't cover it already.
Hello, Nancy.
Hi.
Are there any efforts being made to include farm workers in the NLRB?
It's a great question. As Nancy said, the farm workers are not covered by the National Labor Relations Act. Let me step away from this real quick. They're not covered by the National Labor Relations Act. It's a huge history that goes back to the New Deal. When they wrote the New Deal legislation, FDR needed votes from Southern Democrats and excluded farm workers and domestic workers from the coverages of the National Labor Relations Act in order to shore up those votes from Southern Democrats, especially because farm workers and domestic workers in the South were mostly black folks. And that's kind of like, I mean, political pragmatism, selling them out, I'm not going to make that argument. But it's a great question of, like, where do we go from here? Because the National Labor Relations Act is federal, that leaves it up to the states to be able to pass comprehensive, unionization rights for workers. California did it. It took years and years of organizing and fighting and consumer advocacy and withholding your dollars from those corporations in order to get that passed. I can say that the long-term game in Washington is absolutely to do a very similar thing. There are states that have it currently, but it can be a mixed bag. There's some states like New York, for example, that have unionization rights for farm workers, but it's not as comprehensive and doesn't have some of the legal guarantees and backups as a stronger bill like in California has. So we are looking for that in Washington. In Oregon, I think there are similar their efforts. But that is the long-term game here, for sure. So, great question.
Hi, I've got a question, Nancy, that's clearly outside your expertise because it's not about union members, but it's about the people trying to weaken the union. It's a question really about the other side. If you cannot shine any light, I was kind of intrigued to hear that in the early 70s, these grape strikes happen, and then there are scab labor to go in and pick the grapes. And I was just thinking, who are people who want to pick grapes who aren't already picking the grapes when the union, when the strike began? So I'm just like, do you know anything about the people who opted to do this? Because I would assume if you want to pick grapes, you would have already been doing it. So why is it that when a strike happens, there's all this labor? But then you also, this really interesting point was, you've told a pretty nonviolent story, but then we have these two shootings that occurred, one of them fatal. And could you just flesh out, like, what was going on that all of a sudden we've got people killing people in this labor movement in the early 70s? Thank you.
Well, that is a big question, and it looks like Colin has stepped away. Oh, there he is. Oh, Very good. Very good. Okay. Well, I guess what I can say about the strikebreaker situation is there's always scabs who are gonna go get those jobs because people need jobs. And we do actually have a booklet here on our table. It's called Why We Boycott. The UFW made a film, and it is about that exact time period when the scabs were picking the grapes. The UFW picketers were right there saying, come out of the fields, join the strike. And first the Teamsters brought thugs in, and then the Kern County police, which was much more violent. And you read about the death of Naji Daifala, and it's horrifying. I think he was 24 years old, and he was clubbed, and they broke his head. I mean, and then tossed his body in a ditch. It's shocking. So I don't know. I'm sorry. Back to your question.
I mean, I don't know the details of those two shootings, you said. I'm not particularly familiar with that. I mean, something that I definitely want to read about. I mean, I could say in when you have this many laborers that are out in actions. So, I mean, we look to labor history. There's instances of some, you know, violence, whether that's incited by police or otherwise. So, I mean, I'll look into that, though. It's a great question. I'm not too actually familiar with it. So thank you.
Got one over here. Check out the booklet up here before you leave. Because we actually have this movie, Why We Boycott, but it's a 16-millimeter movie, and we don't have a projector to show it on. So if you can figure out a way to show the movie, I'd love to show it. But we do have our home movie, and this is the March on Gallo. And as you can see, it's getting bigger and bigger as it goes on here. So kind of keep an eye out, because there's some really cool views of Cesar Chavez with his fist up and Joan Baez. Anyway, more questions?
Okay. Yeah, thank you all so much again, and thank you, Nancy, too. My question is on boycotts specifically. We've seen like a lot of boycotts recently through like the boycott, divest, sanction movement, specifically for Palestine. And I was curious if you just had any insight on these previous boycotts that take place. It seems like they're a lot more effective at like stopping value from going to producers and then actually taking the value, and for instance, y'all directly sent the money back to the UFW. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts on what these more, you know, contemporary boycotts could learn, because it seems like there's maybe some stopping of people from purchasing but not actually like a capturing of the value.
It's a great question. I think that the central thing you're getting at is that the tactics that organized labor used in the past, like even just a strike, but also boycotts, with the way that a lot of value is produced by companies now, like this company, Windmill Farms, is owned by a private equity firm, right? And so this company is able to kind of sustain a little bit more economic damage than, let's say, you know, a factory, you know, station in one spot that's all the value that they're accruing is coming out of what they can produce. And if the workers shut it down, it's causing a lot more maximal damage to that company than, you know, it is now. And I think that this is something that organized labor needs to learn from. But I can say that in terms of the through line that I still think is a worthwhile tactic is what is being used here, which is like withholding consumer power. We all go to the grocery store. I mean, I don't even really like mushrooms personally, so I've already been saved from this. But a lot of us go and we buy mushrooms from the grocery store. Your friends and family do. If you withhold on a mass scale your consumer power to buy these mushrooms and buy elsewhere, that will absolutely cause economic damage. Now, we don't lean into, I think that the way to directly answer your question is that we take a multi-pronged strategy. You can't use one tactic. The boycott alone is not going to do it. Consumer power is a humongous part of it. But like the question is, the goal here is, how can we get these workers a contract? What will get the company to come to the table and bargain and give these workers a contract? Because they're not protected under the law, right? So we need to do a boycott. We need to like spread the word. We need to cause them damage to their brand and their reputation. There's the workers on the ground have to organize and you know, build good structures internally in their union. There's a lot of moving pieces into this. So I think the thing to answer is like, I think the boycott as a tactic is harder with the financialized economy now. However, I think it's still a worthwhile tactic if it's one among others.
I would just say, you know, my experience is 50 years ago. And, you know, it was very easy to ask people, don't buy grapes, don't buy lettuce. A little harder, don't shop at Safeway. But we turned away a lot of people. It was sort of like everybody, all walks of life were involved. I mean, we had the church people. We had the union people. You know, it's like just a simple thing of not buying that product. People felt like they were helping and it made a difference. Then they could step up to the next level, join that delegation to talk to the store manager. Next level, be outside that store handing out leaflets and talking about this. So it allowed everybody to do something in some way. And, you know, we had people who, you know, gave us a bad time outside Safeway. I'm thinking of Lois Erickson. We had a really significant group of church women who were part of our picket lines. And one was Lois Erickson, who passed away a number of years ago. She wrote up her experience of standing in front of Safeway talking to people, and she wrote about a conversation she had with a man who came up and told her what the Bible said about how she should not be outside that store talking to people. And she answered him back with a Bible verse. And it was, you know, it's an incredible story. And she was one of the people that helped me learn how to be an activist. So I guess I would just say, I think consumer boycotts are very effective, but we need everybody to help.
Yeah, I'll say one real quick. I just want to add one more thing on that. I think the thing that's important that Nancy said too is like the stores themselves, the companies have an obligation to do the right thing, but they have an opportunity to. And I just got word that a Winco in Yakima, Washington, has committed to not selling moon meal mushrooms anymore. So this is like a winnable thing. And so it's, yeah, great. I mean, these companies do have the opportunity to pull out just in, like, you know, in the BDS movement, like corporations or companies or public institutions have the opportunity to do the right thing. And this is absolutely a winnable campaign for sure.
Okay. Hi. I was just thinking about 50 years ago, Nancy, and it's like the people who were boycotting, they weren't fearful of being deported.
Yeah.
And now we're looking at the people in the mushroom farmers. I mean, that's a new fear. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Am I right on that? Do you want to respond to that?
That the workers' fear of being deported?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there were INS raids. That's why I wanted to bring that in, that, you know, deportations of farm workers is not new. But the fear in our communities now, I mean, for me, it's heartbreaking. I've been doing this so long, and to see what's going on now, being here, that's why I felt compelled to do this talk, is I am not somebody who talks. I love talking to one-on-one, but being in front and behind a microphone is really difficult for me, but I had to do it. And, you know, so thank you. You've been a wonderful audience.
Yeah. I'd like to real quick respond to this question on intimidation tactics. Just the other day, I don't know if you saw the news, but Pakoon, Nancy talked about here, they warned folks not to go to their offices that day because they had confirmed ICE activity surrounding it. I'm seeing heinous stuff on my phone every single morning. And I think what's important to, like, the connection to make here is, like, one, yes, intimidation and the threat of, like, deportation is something that's also leveraged by the company to intimidate and discourage organizing, 100%. And then there's the reality of the deportation raids themselves. And as Nancy said towards the end, UFW is suing the Trump administration. Pakoon is also trying to work on worker protections. And so if we, like, I feel all the time that we are on defense constantly. And the best that we can do is mitigate the damage, but otherwise what's facing us is like, and this heinous stuff is inevitable. That's what it feels like. And this is absolutely an opportunity. And like building, if we win this campaign for windmill workers, we are building United Farm Workers power. And that in turn absolutely translates into a way to go on offense and beat back this onslaught. You know, that's intimidating and kidnapping, you know, farm workers, among others. So I really appreciate the question.
I have one more question for Nancy over here.
Oh, hi, Joni.
I'm wondering, well, I buy my mushrooms at the farmer's market from the Mushroomery. He's a fabulous guy. I believe he grows most of what he sells. But I'm also wondering if there's wholesalers that we could recommend to our local grocers that are not to be boycotted.
Organically grown. A wholesaler.
As a wholesaler.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I'm sure they'd love to have more business. So it is. So I've had conversations with the mushroom buyer at Organically Grown, and he's great. And he did actually say that there is a mushroom company in Oregon, Yamhill Mushrooms, and he does actually buy those mushrooms, and those are at Market of Choice. So, you know, you could, if you're at Market of Choice shopper, you could say, are these windmill or are these Yamhill? You know, so at least you have a choice there. So I thought that was interesting. I personally think marketed choice is doable because they say they're community oriented, and Safeway, Albertsons, but Winco, that's great. That is really good. Yeah. I think we're good for some more questions if anybody else has any.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So when we go to Market of Choice and don't buy their mushrooms, should we tell them, like, should we tell the cashier, hey, I'm not buying those mushrooms because...
Yeah, or the produce manager.
Okay.
Yeah. I guess I can share my Market of Choice story. So I actually went there and had a very nice talk with who I thought was the produce manager. And he was very interested, and the box wasn't labeled, and so he said, let me go back and look, and he came back and said, yes, they are windmill. And I didn't have my leaflet, it was a printing, so I said, you know, I said, oh, well, and he said, I have a weekly meeting with the regional manager, and I'll bring it up. I thought, well, this is really good. So I came back the next week with my leaflet, and I said, oh, you remember me, and did you have a chance to talk to the regional manager? And he said, no, I didn't. And he said, I'm actually the assistant produce manager. You need to talk with the produce manager. And so I said, oh, is he here? He said, yeah, he's over there with the bananas. I went over there, and he was not friendly. He did not want to hear about it. He would not take my leaflet. So kind of mixed review over there at Market of Choice. But, yeah, there are other brands is the good thing. If you buy mushrooms, you know, buy another brand. And you could try saying, you know, this is why I'm buying this brand of mushrooms is because, you know, I don't want to buy windmill, or, you know, if you're at Safeway and that's all they have, go somewhere else for your mushrooms. But tell them, I'm not buying mushrooms today because you only have windmill mushrooms. So they need to start hearing from us. Mm-hmm. And we have a sign-up list here. If you would like to help us, go to stores, talk to managers. We need some people to help us do that. So, you know, and you can say, I'm, you know, I go to church at the Lutheran church, and I'm going to tell our church members about this. And, you know, kind of, we'll help you learn what to say. So.
I got one question from someone in the back here.
Hello. Some of you might know me. My name is Will. I am a rank and file member of UO Student Workers, UAW 8121, as well as the co-chair of the Eugene Springfield Democratic Socialist America Labor Working Group. First of all, thank you so much, Nancy, for doing this talk. It's so, you know, valuable, I think, to those of us who are only recent additions to the labor movement to hear about all of this that was going down decades before we were even born. And then my question for you, sorry, Colin, I think I can get this answer from you at a different time, is like, what advice would you give to those of us who are young organizers in the labor movement, and like specifically the Starbucks workers who right now are on strike for their first contract, and also calling for a boycott of Starbucks until they get that?
Boy, young people. Okay. I love talking to young people. And actually, 2 weeks ago, I was invited to give this same talk at the U of O Multicultural Center, and there were 30 students there. And it was really wonderful, because we need you. We need you to step up. We need you to get passionate about issues that you want to get involved in. And, you know, that's what happened to me. I can't not do this now. My husband, unfortunately, he's right there with me. We met working on the boycott, and he learned how to be a printer graphic designer because we needed leaflets. We have a notebook there, and most of those leaflets in there were designed and printed by him. And we're still together 50 years later. So that's why we have all this stuff, is because, you know, here it is. We still have it. I just to say, find what you're passionate about, and then just keep working on it, and don't give up. And it's been hard for me. I have to be honest, I've been heartbroken about what's going on. But look at all of you here who want to hear about this. I mean, this really lifts my spirit, so thank you.
This is just a quick addendum. I just bought mushrooms from Canada at Winco on Chad Drive. So they're out there.
Canadian company? Windmill.
I saw a hand over here.
I mean, yeah, if they're not windmill mushrooms, they're not boycotted. So that's great. I think just to be safe, like, always check the label. You know, if... It could say Windmill Farms, or it could say from Sun. Like, I've seen this too. It's like a creative way of, it sounds like they might be getting wind of what we're doing, which is good. Means we're winning. But they've started changing the label. So they'll have like the store brand label, but it'll still say from Sunnyside, Washington. So they won't say Windmill Farms, but those are windmill mushrooms. So you got to be kind of a little bit diligent about that. If it says it's from Sunnyside, Washington, or Windmill Farms, just buy elsewhere. It is a little hit and miss with the grocery store chains. I mean, they do a lot of that ordering on like a regional or district level. So you just be diligent. But those are the stores that we can confirm at least that are in Oregon that we know to carry them at least at some, if not most, of their stores for sure. But thank you for being diligent about it.
Okay, here's a couple of questions. First of all, I've had situations where there'll be a contractor or a construction site, and it'll be time to pay the workers, and the boss, the employer, will call ICE himself, and so he doesn't have to pay. And then there's also the situation, I wonder if anything's gotten any better with pesticides and insecticides that they use on the spray over the farm workers.
Well, I'm not sure I can speak to either of those, but in terms of pesticides, definitely United Farm Workers was in the forefront of trying to at least reduce the pesticide use. I will say, when I was at the migrant camp, the farmer, all around the camp, there were beets. And the farmer said, don't pick those beets. Don't eat those beets, because DDT is in the irrigation water that was being sprayed over the entire field. So, you know, Beyond Toxics has done a lot of work and has close connections with Pecun. So, you know, support Beyond Toxics. I think it's improved, but, you know, buy organic if you can.
We have time, maybe. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry, Marsha.
I was just going to say we have time for one more question.
Okay, I'll be really quick. Just to respond to your first part, I mean, yeah, the workers on, especially on H-2A visas, the United Farm Workers talks about, like Nancy mentioned, Trump administration voted to try to cut wages for them, UFW suing them. The visa status is used as a intimidation tactic by the employers all the time. Whether that's directly calling ICE, I haven't heard. I'm sure that happens. But like more often than not, it's just used as a threat to like keep workers in line and discourage them from organizing. One of the early things that happened at Windmill was a number of mostly women union organizers were fired by the company, and that obviously comes with legal ramifications for those people. So that's absolutely something that the company uses. Thanks for bringing it up.
So I just have a quick question. I'm a little confused. If you're in favor or against H-2A visas, because a lot of the people who are working don't have any documented status, and they're in a worse position than if they do have the visas. And then also there's this question about being housed, and I worked for Senator Wyden years ago and remember going out with Picoon, and the housing conditions were so horrifying, and if they took that away, I feel like they might be better than requiring people to live in farm provided housing. So
thank you very much for asking this question. This is a great question asked. Like, well, you know, are we against H-2A visas if they're being used as a way to also control workers? Well, yes, obviously we want, you know, a easy pathway for visa entry and a somewhat of a legal status. The problem what is happening is that is being used as a form of economic coercion. So it's either the option of you come here risking everything or you get on this visa. And if they're allowed to just cut your wages and like not guarantee you the rights to unionize, they're being pushed around basically. And like you said, I'm on the housing conditions. I mean, I'm not sure I don't think that's the case. I don't think they have that set up at Windmill, but other places, absolutely. It's, you know, they're horrific, company town type stuff, right? Where the companies will own some of the lodging. And yeah, there's just no, the overall problem is we don't have a strong enough visa system to guarantee rights that and fair pay and dignity on the job for these workers. And so it's not to say like the H-2A program it should be like get rid of or something, or that we're for it or against it. The problem is we need to strengthen it and not allow the federal government to just like arbitrarily cut wages for all these workers, because that just puts them in a tight bind. It's either that or they go undocumented. So that, it's a great question. Thanks for asking. I appreciate the clarification.
Thank you for that, Colin. I want to say just one last word. The first book that I wrote was on migrant agricultural workers, the so-called Okies. And what I learned from that, speaking to the housing issue, is, well, two issues that were raised. One was about Kern County and the violence. And I'll just say that Kern County has been famous for its violence against farm workers for a generation before that happened. And so it doesn't surprise me at all. But also, when the Bracero program was introduced during World War II, they required housing to be provided before that. People just camped on irrigation ditches and had the most despicable conditions that you can believe, drinking and washing dishes and clothes and all of that out of irrigation ditches, which were also carrying pesticides as well. So, I guess the challenge is to make standards for housing that within the law, and they did not do that. They just said you had to provide housing. So at any rate.
So if you have a chance to come up at our table here, I do have the signboard that was at the camp I lived in that has to do with the housing, which is interesting to look at now. So what I know about farmworker housing, it was really bad back then. Definitely there were inspections taking place, but the farmers also got around those inspections. As an example, the camp that I lived at, the farmer was told that there had to be screen doors on each of the cabins. And so what he did was to pay somebody to cut a hole in the front on the door and put a screen across. And so that took care of that requirement. So on the other hand, you know, what's happened to the migrant camps, you know, there's not very many anymore. farmers went to mechanization. That farmer I worked for quit growing pole beans, basically, you know, started growing bush beans that could be harvested by machine. So migrants have settled. So there are still migrant camps, but they, as far as I know, they are much more stringently inspected. But yeah, it's been a long process for that. So thank you for your question.
Thanks again. I want to encourage you all, if you enjoyed yourself tonight, to continue to come to History Pub. Our next History Pub will be, January 12th. And we always meet on the second Monday of the month up through May. And the talk will be by Charisse Chaney, who is with the Indigenous Race and Ethnic Studies Program at the U of O. She will be speaking on Blacks Against Brown, the interracial struggle over segregated schools in Topeka, Kansas. And I think that's going to be a really interesting talk that many of you will be interested in. So thank you again. As a long-term union member, I really appreciate the talk that you've given and hope that all of you will come up here to the front and see the incredible stuff, the material that she has here. And then go to that Springfield History Museum exhibit when it comes next spring. July. So come and see that. Thank you very much for coming, and we'll see you next month.
At World Pies from December 8th, and you can get more information on from Nancy Bray at branj@gmail.com, and it's Eugene Friends of the Farm Workers, branj@gmail.com. Thanks for supporting independent media.
Speaking of, why do you do this? Your next comic coming to the stage. He's a DJ on KEPW. Please give it up for Curtis B.
Thank you. All right, so I've been doing this routine on school shootings, and now there's been a bunch of shootings. So I just have a little disclaimer here. Because I know you guys come to these things to forget about life for a while, but I can't let you do that. So, I grew up in L.A. and in the 60s and 70s, and we never locked our doors at all. So I don't mean to preach to you, but I lived in Sherman Oaks, and Manson threw his gun three doors down from me. The Manson family, when they were escaping, they threw their gun three doors down from me. So, and we still didn't lock our doors. And when I moved up here, I was delivering bagels to the Thurston School right when they did the Thurston School shooting. So I just want to say, and I don't mean to preach to you guys, but I don't know who said it, but when you can't create, you tend to destroy. And that's where I think this is all coming from, because the more you're a cog in a machine, the more you're a cog in a corporate machine, the more school shootings you're going to see, you know, the more your life doesn't have value. So anyway, that's all I wanted to say on that just before I do my my routine on school shootings. Because, I hate to break it to you, but you guys all know about Santa and the Easter Bunny and the Tooth Fairy. And if you don't know about that, I don't want to break it to you, but there's some stuff about Rudolph that you guys didn't know. Okay, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Rudolph, he was incel. He was involuntarily celibate. Reindeer games weren't the only games that he wasn't playing in. Okay, what I'm saying is he wasn't getting any venison. And by the way, just as an aside, Rudolph was the hero of the story, but what if he was just different? And didn't save the day with his red nose? What if he was just different? So what I wrote is called Rudolph the Black-Clothed Reindeer. Okay, Rudolph the Black-Clothed Reindeer, because Rudolph was insult. So Rudolph the Black-Clothed Reindeer always wore a black trench coat. Rudolph the Black-Clothed Reindeer, he even wore two pair of black fishnet hose. None of the other reindeer would let him play in their games. They never let poor Rudolph play in any reindeer games. They made fun of Rudolph. So one pale afternoon, Rudolph went to Santa's workshop and 3D printed a gun. He shot all the other reindeer, and now he's on the run. They blamed Santa because he shouldn't let reindeer tease, Now Santa's been indicted for trafficking endangered reindeer species. Rudolph the reindeer, Rudolph the black-nosed reindeer, you'll go down in history on social media. Rudolph, why didn't they just let you play? Rudolph, you just wanted to play in their games. Reindeer games, reindeer games. All right, I originally wrote this as a speed metal song, but I had to slow it down, and so I've copyrighted. I want the speed metal version and the rap version, and the Scott version would be Rudy, the black clothes reindeer. All right, that's all I got. Thank you. Merry Christmas. Here he is, and give it up for your host Seth Milstein and yourselves for supporting Open Mic Comedy, and check out KEPW 97.3 FM.
Keep it going.